now time to think outside the box of what we've always known.
I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord.
I think that's a profound turning point in somebody's relationship with God.
And our hope in starting this was that this would become an ever-expanding conversation.
Just two real guys talking about life. That's a nice tagline.
I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Brad Cummings.
And welcome to another edition of The God Journey.
Hey, surf's up, dude.
Surf's up here? Yeah, big waves.
Big waves.
Big waves.
Big publishing waves.
Oh, you're not talking about the beach waves.
The big beach waves are cool, too, but, dude, that's not the tsunami I've been surfing.
Oh, my gosh.
We got ourselves a little publishing phenomenon here. We do.
Time will tell if it's a blessing or not.
No, it's a blessing. It's cool. You know what's so fun?
You know, it is a blessing on the one end of the fact that that book's getting out there from two yahoos having a clue as to how to get that book out there.
See, that's the fun part.
That is the fun part. The other part is...
What's the other part?
All the vultures who gather around the pie. It's been hilarious. It's every day there's an email from some publisher who wants to take it over for us to bless us, and
it's the one ring of power. You know it's so fun though.
It's the one ring of power. What,
yeah,
the book?
My precious.
You know. Oh, you got people who want to make audiobooks, people who want to make big letter edition books. I mean, it's amazing what's out there just waiting to say, I'm going to see something working, and then I'm going to jump in there and try and get a piece of that pie. It's amazing. We're going to beat them off with sticks.
But beside all that, there are so many other people that this thing is so getting to their heart and kind of cutting through the thick of all that. I've had so many wonderful phone calls of people that are just – it's like they've been romanced back to this awesome, wonderful idea of God. They're just going like, I always wanted him to be this wonderful. And now he feels like that.
Yeah, the big shock is God's not the mean, evil, nasty tyrant I've been taught all my life he is. That's what people are really struggling with.
Yeah, what's amazing is that is such a shockwave, and that it's having such a profound – you're just going like, well, who told you that?
Oh, I know who told him that. Everybody told him that.
I know, but I don't think any – I look at this from a standpoint that I think most people, you know, it's like you're just sort of opening things up and they're going like, wow, you know, that is really wonderful. It's not as if they didn't know that or didn't think that, honestly. I think most people are going like, yeah, this rings so true. But the residual, the fear-based stuff, the manipulation of it, it's like the God's going to ding you if. It's like that somehow is getting wiped off the board, and they're just falling more in love with Jesus.
Or even if he does love us, the general disposition of God is he's just ticked all the time. He's just angry. And even if he loves you, it's because you got to fix something because it's just torquing his hide. And the whole idea that God is especially fond of you and that God really cares and that God really wants to rescue us out of all the places where we've got lost just has gotten lost in the message. A message of salvation and hell and heaven and getting saved, and we've lost the sense. And I love that about, I think what the shack helps people recover is, this is a God of incredible love and compassion and mercy, and he has always wanted to rescue people from the dark chaos of a broken world. It's just always been in his heart, and gosh, I just take...
And we haven't been abandoned, even in our darkest nightmare, he's there.
Right.
And he's with us, and he'll walk us out of it.
And he's not the author of our dilemmas. He's not the author of, and even our failures don't earn God's desire to thump us. That little quote I read this morning, put on the blog today, that was so cute of actually Missy talking to Mac, or at least talking about Missy to Mac. One of the characters just says, you know, God, even if it were your fault, God's love is still stronger than that, or love is still stronger than that. I just, man, that's a beautiful way to say that. So it's been fun.
So surf's up.
It's a bit overwhelming, though. People are asking me how much sleep you're getting. I know they're asking you what kind of underwear I'm wearing.
Yeah, I do.
They're asking me how much sleep you're getting.
I don't know that I remember getting much. I've been going to bed about 4 in the morning. I kind of wave at the
sun. And getting over here about noon, so getting good 8 hours in, are you?
Yeah. You know, the folks on the West Coast, East Coast, they don't realize that West Coast folks' business day doesn't start before, you know, 6 a.m. Your phone starts ringing at 6 a.m.
Your phone has an off switch.
I know.
Okay.
But it still rings. And there's 20 messages by the time I get up. It's hilarious. The thing that I'm loving is just the transformational ripple effect of changed lives. It's just all over
that's
the place.
That's the best part of this.
And you can't stop it. Yeah. So it's fun.
It's the best part of this. How many lives have been changed?
It sure's up, dude.
New hardback version's out. Got one in my grubby little paws right here. This
yeah.
This is pretty...
looking pretty sweet.
We've done this backwards. You know, everybody else usually does the hardback first, make everybody pay the big bucks for the hardback version, and then you slip in the paperback for summer reading. We've... like everything else, done that backwards. We did the paperback first. But we've had so many people ask us to say, could we just have a hardback? Because we'd like to have something more permanent and more enduring.
Now you
so,
can.
Yep, they're available now. Not through the God Journey, though.
I was talking to the...
Got to go windblown for that.
Yeah. I was talking to the senior guy at Barnes & Noble. And, you know, they don't know what the book's about. They just see it, that it's selling bazonkers. And so he's, you know, he was just laughing when he's trying to figure out what was going on. And I said, yeah, you know, we've probably spent maybe $200 in marketing. And he just burst out laughing. And I said, you know, we're bringing a hardback. He says, you know, that's backwards. I said, yeah, everything's backwards. Whatever rules there were, we didn't know. Someone just gave us crayons and we're coloring outside the lines and having a hoot about it. And I just had a wonderful I have no idea where this guy is with God, but he's absolutely intrigued. And it's just fun.
It is fun. It's the kind of thing that I'm sure every publisher in the world. I had a little exchange with a former publisher of mine. And they were talking about the book, and they'd passed. They'd been one of those companies that passed on it. And so they were kind of like, I said, I don't see how people miss stuff like this. And her answer was, well, if you've not done it before, if no one's done it before, we can't do it. And if somebody has done it before, we can't do it. What she called the catch 22 of all that. But as we went on to exchange that, she said, you know, I guess if this was an exact science, anybody could do it. And my answer to her was, you know, we're in a day when anybody actually can do it. You know,
yeah.
A couple of yahoos can put a book together and put it out there on the internet and find an audience for it. And we are past the day where publishing companies get to control what people read.
Yeah.
And I think that's a great day. I mean, it gets a lot of junk published as well. But I tell you, to take all that power out of all these publishers who saw this book, who evidently did or did not see its brilliance, but decided either way, we can't publish this book. We can't. And now, because it's just – nothing's changed about the content.
Right.
But just because it's successful now, we'd wish we'd done that book. And that to me, that's how publishing – and this has been a long time issue for me, obviously, being a writer. But the publishing industry in the last 20 years in the Christian has moved from family-owned companies with vision and passion to accomplish something to be owned by corporations who only have an interest in marketing books to a Christian demographic that they hold in their head, that they can't see something creative and wonderful when it actually lands on their desk. They can't see it.
Yeah.
And now they just see the bottom line and money and boy, we have numbers and we got to get down on that.
But, you know, it's even changing dynamics within that framework, because a handful of conversations I've had with some of those executive people is sort of bringing them back to their first love of why they went into publishing in the first place. When they hear the little story of what we're doing, which is more, we have passion. We don't have a plan.
Nor much brain.
Yeah, so they asked me for our business plan, and I just laughed. I said, what? I said, I can't even catch up to what's happening. You want me to plan?
And someone asked me, are you guys going to advertise? And I'm going,
why?
Not until we can catch up with orders. At some point, if we get caught
There's
up.
No point.
We took what, 50,000 new books in a few weeks ago?
Half of them are going in a week.
And we're already ordering another
50,000.
A run. So it's just nuts. I really can't imagine how we got our – that's why I didn't want to do this. That's why I wanted
somebody else
to do this for
us. It's fun now. It's good.
Anyway, it is good, and we're glad folks are enjoying it. So,
This God guy, he's amazing.
Got this email last week or a couple of weeks. Actually, it's a letter. Actually, somebody wrote a letter. This is the first letter I've seen, I think, with the God Journey on it. It says, listening to the podcast encourages me to keep moving forward on the journey when I sometimes feel as though all I'm doing is floundering. I hear in you and Brad the freedom in Christ that I so desire, but do not fully allow myself to experience yet. That's good words.
Yeah.
I don't allow myself to experience yet. I've come to now see with clarity that it is a journey of transitioning me from living a life for him to living a life in him.
That's good.
Yeah, that's really
good. Talk about nailing it on the head.
Boy, because we have so much of that. Boy, we got to do stuff for God and work hard for God. And boy, he just wants us to walk alongside him. He's got treasures to unfold and life to make real. And
you know, I mean, I still have little kids, so this is where the little illustration comes out of. But that day when you first take off the training wheels and the exhilaration of that first bike ride, It's like you've been pedaling along, and you can lean, and you got something that you're not going to fall down, and so that's nice to have the training wheels. And, you know, Taylor's kind of at that point where it's like, you know, she likes that. But it's not the same as really riding a bike, because anytime you really try to ride, those training wheels really drag down the experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then it's that frightening reality of, okay, daddy's running along behind, he's holding on, it's good. And then that one point where it's like, you're riding on your own, and it's like the eyeballs just go, you know, huge, and it's like, wow, and the exhilaration of, oh. And you know what? It's a capacity that's there, but if you never get rid of the training wheels, if all the good things that sometimes, you know, if the institution can bring something, they can sometimes do that training wheel effect, but if you never at some point get free to the actual riding and the enjoyment of what that relationship is, it's like, wow, you know, I don't want to be on a trike. I don't want to be on a bicycle.
Well, we got this from Gary. It kind of reflects what you're just saying. He says, thanks for the clarification that you and Brad discussed on Don't Miss Your Party. I have to admit that I was uncomfortable at times with the podcast, as it did seem to have a church bashing feel to it. The other people are saying, what? You guys never do church bashing. You guys don't do enough of winging on it. But anyway, different strokes, different
folks. We all hear what we want to hear.
While I might have left organized religion, I still fellowship with many dear brothers and sisters who do, and I do not call attention to my being beyond the box or demonize it in a dysfunctional, reactionary way. I also believe strongly that I wouldn't be where I am today in a relationship with the Heavenly Father without having been exposed to fellowship in an organized religious experience. I learned so much in the early years of attending church that eventually I came to realize that perhaps I merely had outgrown it, along with the realization that church can never be equated with God. But God and His love for us can use whatever means there is in the world to reach us and invite us to be loved by Him. God can use anything, including an organized church, to reach us and to help our journey and life in Him. And I think we've said that a lot. I think that's been our point. The training wheels analogy, just you, I think, is a good one for that. It's saying, gosh, a lot of us, I got my hunger for Scripture there. I got my hunger for Jesus there. I got a hunger for fellowship there, even though it kind of moved beyond its ability to provide it. And I think that became an issue over time. Most groups, when they get started or when they're young or fresh or alive, it's all about relationships, and it's family and friendships and people enjoying each other. And then the more it has to structure itself into an organized entity and has got to, and then needs this religious overlay of performance and people got to perform, then all the fellowship goes out of it. You end up like that lady you talked to at the publishing company that just was being recaptured from why I got into publishing. And now I'm in a company that's not doing that anymore.
Right.
I mean, we're still putting books out there, but we're not in
not
the process.
Not with a fresh passion that first began this.
Not with we're excited about this, and we're taking a risk, and let's see what happens. Because the larger something gets, the less risk it can take. And it's almost like we move backwards with the bicycle. We start without the training wheels, and we got our...
Ooh, we're riding it.
We got our shin skinned up and our elbows raked out, you know. And so, oh, boy, let's put training wheels on everybody. It'll keep everybody safer. And maybe it does keep everybody safer in some limited, weird, wacky sense. But like you say, it doesn't allow people the exhilaration of, man, there are no training wheels on this thing.
Yeah,
I can
face-to-face
turn and
relationship.
Roll around. Yeah, and I, boy.
You know, it's interesting to me, though, but I think we sometimes mistake that, you know, it's the organized whatever. That's what gave me life. And it's like, you know what? I think probably more correctly, it was an alive individual within that context. That just was the setting in which you met that person. That's the setting in which two hearts rubbed up next to each other. And I think in all of this, it really is where there is life in somebody, regardless of the context that it's set in, that life is indestructible and is going to be like a virus you can't stop. It's going to be communicated, and it's going to be caught by somebody else. And I think when we can step back and realize it isn't about the structures or the systems, that really is like leaves on a tree. It's not the issue of the life and the sap. The reality is are you around some folks who's got the life of Jesus flowing in their veins, and are you enjoying the sharing of that?
Yeah, and wouldn't it be true beyond just the people, because I think that's a big, big part of it. I also think it's where people first recognized perhaps the presence of God in their lives. Because wasn't that he wasn't there before, or he didn't try to make himself known.
They're awakened to it.
But in more of a sanctioned setting, they could give more voice to that reality or recognize that reality. So I would agree with Gary. I think there's some valuable things that can do.
Yeah.
I think what he also says is maybe we grow out of that. And I would even ask this question. Maybe the institution has grown out of that itself. Because what churches were, quote unquote, what congregations were 40 years ago are very different than what they are today.
Yeah.
It used to be much more family-based, people that knew each other. The services weren't as important as the relationships were. Now we've got these highly structured machines, and you don't even know the people you're sitting next to. And
it's putting on a great event. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, people can really enjoy that.
It may be very aesthetic, and it may touch something very emotional in us, just like the media can do, or a good movie can do the same thing.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with it. But is it, bottom line, always comes back to, is it allowing you to know him and to walk in the freedom of being loved by the Father of the universe? And if whatever you're doing does that, great, hang in there. If it's not doing that, then don't be limited by that. Look for other ways that God can and wants to make himself known. I think it's that simple, really.
That's awesome. You mentioned that Billy Graham thing.
Well, somebody sent me this quote. I've tried to figure out if this is true or not. This was actually linked to Billy Graham's Last Crusade, which was in New Orleans, I hear. And this quote is ostensibly from Billy Graham, but I've tried to Google it. So I don't know if it is for sure, but I mean, so I like
truth
the
truth and packaging warning. It hasn't been fully verified.
And if someone can verify that it is, let us know. Or verify that it's not, let us know. But the point's still made. I love the point. If I could do my life over again, I wouldn't focus on the stadium events. I would instead get 12 men and disciple them on how to reach the world.
Wow. Wow. I mean, as someone who's been involved with some of the stadium pushers out there.
Pushers?
Yeah,
okay.
Kind of.
Okay.
Not meaning to disparage.
I want my share of the pie.
No, but I think there is... I think there's sometimes a real mixture of a desire to feel successful or to somehow have your moment of fame that really becomes a pull in some arenas for that. I think there's a brilliance there when you just go like, you know what? This life is really shared in the context of relationships. You didn't see Jesus coming and planning citywide invasions in the Gospels. Isn't that bizarre? Of all the ways that, God, and you figure... Few miracles can draw a crowd, and yes, they had crowds, but it didn't seem that Jesus was ever looking for that. And in the midst of the crowds, he never lost sight of the individual. That's what always blew my mind when it comes to just everyday church, because I had always so many things going on. It was pretty easy to all of a sudden lose sight of the fact that the importance and value of dropping all of that for this little individual. And you're just going like, Jesus never did that. And I wonder why.
Yeah, if he did say this, and I would tend to think he probably didn't. I think it's kind of too slick, and it's reminiscent of what Moody said. Give me 12 men who will follow God. I'll change the world. So it's very similar to that. And the reason I wonder if it's true, if it is true, it would be awful sad that finally on the twilight of your life, you realize you didn't put your time in the most important place. I mean, that would be – it's a little late to learn this lesson.
That's if you could reduce his life to the events.
Which would be silly, but I think this statement seems to say it was.
Right.
I would focus on, that's why I'm not thinking it's a real statement, but the sentiment is, in terms of the competition between stadium events and finding 12 people,
you
could help. I mean, then you got, here's what Jesus did versus here's what men do to try and make something out of God, maybe bigger than he is, or not bigger than he is, but trying to make something out of God that isn't the way he works and it's not the best way he makes himself known to people.
Right. Well, I just look at the dynamic of, I would draw the parallel of what's happening with the shack. There's no mothership that's directing the affairs of this book. Contrary to anyone's presupposition, you're just like, no, I'm sorry. If there was, I was in it, and it's not doing it. The reality is this is excited life that is capturing hearts and is simply being passed along friend to friend, where there's a genuine place of connection, a genuine place of relationship. Something's happening and someone else gets excited because of someone's personal testimony. And when you look at that, it's like, that is so profoundly inhabitable by the Holy Spirit. There's no fanfare. There's no budget to have to do. There's no, well, we got to make this more efficient. It's like, how could it be more effective? It can't be. and it's just real. And where it's genuine and real, it works. You don't have to advertise a fire. It seems like it advertises itself. And when you look at the simple investment in lives, I think it's that we try to take on the big task that really is very well managed in the heart of God. I don't know that it's so well managed in the heart of man trying to mass produce these disciples. It just, you know, it's like, I think in our desire for bigger is better, it doesn't really work. You know, the whole Willow Creek implosion thing that's going on, just go like, you know what? I think when this comes down to the real power in the life of the shared life of this journey, the community aspect, it really is found where there's hearts that are related, not just people sitting in the same arena. That's nice, but if you don't know the people next to you, there's nothing going on.
Yeah, that's true. Yep. And we've got, you know, we've got the Pope taking a shot at atheism.
Almost, oh, really?
Almost
what
the
a
same,
surprise.
Well, almost in the same context. How does something large, encompassing as an organization ever authentically represent God in the world? That's what we're talking about. You know, God, Jesus wanted to pass this on life to life. Whether it's stadium events, whether it's the Roman Catholic Church, the Baptist Club, you know, whatever, we keep trying to put it into these huge institutions and then wonder why they don't reflect the life of God to the culture. And part of that, he's saying that we must acknowledge that modern Christianity hasn't lived up to anything in letting the world known. But to do that, he's got to take a strike at atheism. And I thought what was interesting about this when I saw this article. He said, it is no accident that this idea, atheism, has led to the greatest forms of cruelty and violations of justice, he wrote. The greatest have come from it. And he uses Marxism and the Soviet Union and Lenin and all those kinds of things.
And what's he say about the Inquisition?
Let me think. The Inquisition.
Is that listening?
No, I might be here. You know.
That wasn't atheism spawned. That was.
I think what he's saying is that theirs was worse. I think that's the point. I think
okay.
It was later in the history of the world. It had to involve more people and maybe more diabolical ways of torturing them. Now, somehow he doesn't mention that part. But at the same time, somebody sent us this from Time Magazine early in December. Atheists are having Sunday school.
What?
I thought this is
Friday night school, Sunday school.
They're
going head to head.
And this is becoming a bit
on
of a
the
phenomenon.
Holy day.
Enough to, you know, you say a bit of a phenomenon, enough to catch Time's eye to write an article. But when you actually read the article, there's like five groups in five cities that
there's
are
25 people.
Yeah,
someplace.
So,
okay.
Yeah, but anyway, they're thinking it's a trend.
Got the gift of polarity.
Anyway, they quoted one mom as saying, when you have kids, you start to notice that your coworkers or friends have church groups to help teach their kids values and to be able to lean on. And so then you realize your kids don't. And she said, so then you don't want your kid. Here's what it is. It's important for kids not to look weird, says Peter Bishop, who leads a preteen class at the Humanist Center in Palo Alto. You know what's funny about this when I read
what
this?
What do they teach in an atheist Sunday school? Well, what are the values that you kind of promote, and what do they stem from?
You ever been to an atheist meeting?
I have not. You have.
I did. I went to one a while back. We talked about it on a podcast a long time ago. But they're actually, I mean, I was surprised at how most atheists I know are very benevolent atheists. Look, I don't think there's a God out there. But if you do,
God bless
you. Be my guest.
Oh, no. He doesn't bless you.
Yeah. It can't be that.
Whatever bless you.
But if the militant guys, the militant ones are people that they grew
angry.
They grew up pastor's children. They grew up in deals, and they just feel like their whole life was ruined.
God let them down someplace.
By religion.
Okay.
And I don't think they separate between God and religion. They haven't.
Right.
So all the abuses of religion have fell on them in God's name. And at this one meeting I was at, they were had a 20-minute presentation on why it's not even possible that Moses ever existed on the planet, and there was all this historical evidence.
Oh.
I'm sitting there going, wow, they're really serious about this stuff. You know, there's a lot of things in the world I don't believe in.
Right.
I have no compulsion to go study it and beat on people who do, and I just think that's bizarre. But what they're saying is, here's what I thought was hilarious. It's important for kids not to look weird.
Right.
Now, when I went to – this is – almost 50 years ago, well, 45 anyway, when I'm in grade school, I'm one of about five kids I knew that went to Sunday school. I felt weird because I went.
Now they feel weird because they don't.
I don't know what's happening in Palo Alto. I mean, this is
Northern
California.
Yeah.
How is it that a kid in the school is going to feel weird because they don't go to Sunday school? And most kids who are going to Sunday school are looking for a way out of it. They're not feeling like, ooh, you should come. This is great stuff.
Yeah, that is a little odd if you look at the rest of the statistics out there.
But what they're trying to do is to help kids. I think this is what they want to do. This is part of, you know, the whole Pledge of Allegiance in America. We pledge allegiance to the flag, one nation under God. And there's a lawsuit that's been resurrected trying to get under God out of the Pledge of Allegiance. And it's an atheist from Northern California who's just, you know, feeling like, boy, that's ramming down our throat, that which we don't want to. I heard a radio show this week out of San Francisco. They're passing out the guidelines that the city of San Francisco passed out to all its employees about what you can and cannot have on your work environment, as to the holy holidays coming up. And you're not even allowed a star, because the star goes back to – so you can't – if you got a tree on your desk, tree's okay.
But no star on the tree.
Not okay.
Whoa.
It's too Christian.
Oh, my goodness.
What's sad about this is there really is a secular humanist bent in the world that really wants to drive any expression of religion from the public place. But that is an incredibly small number of people. Most people you meet on the street, even people who don't believe in God, will give you a Merry Christmas, or if Jewish people will say, you know, Happy Hanukkah, or even just wish you a Merry Christmas, because it's merry for you. Even if they, most people in the world, 99% of them, are generous with the fact that we don't see these things the same way. And if somebody wishes you season's greetings, it's
fine.
Not an occasion to be offended, even if you don't enjoy the season, for Pete's sake. But atheists are those who feel like they've been had this religion forced on them. It has detrimentally impacted their lives. And so I thought the Pope's response was interesting. So the response to people who feel like their religion has crushed them, God just doesn't exist because of all that pain, and the best thing you can think to do is come and say, you're responsible for all the bad stuff that's ever happened in the world.
How is this helpful?
I'm like, okay, look, I know he's got an organization to run. I know he's got to bring all that stuff together, make it work. But I'm thinking that's a pretty bizarre way to take care of the problem.
It does remind me of another little couple in a garden where it says, the woman you gave me, she caused me to eat.
It's those atheists. The world is a mess because of the atheists.
Yeah, it's not the anger that finds a way into the human heart that justifies a thousand evils.
And doing the bridge builder work I do, see, I know that most people really understand, at least in America over the last 200 years, it's been Christianity that's been in power. If you're an atheist or an unbeliever in America, except for the last 20, 30, when that's made some change, but still, by and large, our rites of passage, political campaigns, everybody's claiming some kind of thing with God because that's important to be elected. So you can understand why they're going to feel like, what do you mean we're the majority of the culture? They don't at all feel. In fact, only 14% of Americans wouldn't claim any religion at all. So for the Pope to say all the bad stuff in the world's come from the atheists would be a little bit overreaching, I would think.
Yeah, it would seem to me that it's the inflamed, zealous, you know, extremism of the belief in God and how they picture him that really has spawned a lot of awful stuff. It hasn't – I don't know of the guys that stand up there and say, you know, in the name of nobody, I am doing this. It's usually everyone's claiming some kind of higher power to empower this, and this is all, you know, God's on our side. Usually the folks who are really, really fighting it out are trying to pull some kind of supernatural power into this.
Yeah, absolutely. And yet the larger question behind this, maybe this is where the through line of what all we've been talking about here. Whenever even something like Christianity coalesces into a visible system, it becomes less a reflection of its true self. It becomes less of an expression of that. And when it's gathered in some way, I've read a lot on this. I think it's important that somehow we realize that Christianity, let me say Christianity because that's a whole religion thing I don't necessarily want to talk about. Let's say the life of Christ is not best expressed in any kind of structured setting. One of my great heroes from the bridge builder work I do is the former the founding governor of the state of Rhode Island, Roger Williams. And he was a Puritan pastor, and he came to the realization that there is no way to invest the life of Christ into any kind of structure that has to work by compulsion, that has to compel people to compel people to attend. He said the life of Christ can only exist among people who freely choose to live that life of their own volitional choice of conscience. And any attempt to push someone to do what isn't in their conscience to do. He called it the rape of the soul. That's strong language.
But it's accurate.
He said, you rape someone's soul when you try to make them do for your beliefs what is not in their beliefs. And he further said this, just from the pragmatics of how we make this available to the world, his comment was this. If we're trying to force somebody to accept our beliefs, we actually alienate them from the God we want them to love.
Yeah.
And I think that's the sum of all that we've been talking about on this
video. Well, I mean, it's wild. You can get somebody to do something, but you can't get somebody to believe something. Not on the inward part of their heart.
You can only ask them to pretend it.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm going to say...
You get outward compliance.
Absolutely.
You can force
hold a gun to someone's head.
Yeah, I mean, and they'll do whatever. But in terms of where do the things of life flow out of, they flow out of the heart, and that isn't under the jurisdiction of being able to, you know, under compulsion. It's at the end of the day, someone may outwardly do something that you forced them to do, but you haven't joined their heart to that.
Yeah. And we're going to see this. I think if people are not aware of this, in the next week or so, The Golden Compass is opening up as a movie. It's supposed to be.
Yeah, we talked about it a little bit.
It's the atheist version of The Lord of the Rings. You know, something like that, I guess. I guess the author is pretty anti-religious. Christian groups are now painting him anti-Christian. I guess what he's really anti, from some of the stuff I've read on interviews, I mean, he's really anti the whole religious structure that represses people. In just the ways we've been talking about, and
see, you peel off a lot of the fear-filled criticisms of him and the characterizations of him. I don't know him.
I don't either.
But you look at just the storyline of what's going on in that movie, and just some of the summary treatments. I'm looking at that and we're like, oh, awesome. Oh, I agree. And you just go like, that is so bizarre when you got all these other little moms groups that are just like, we're going to boycott and we're going to, you know, don't go see it. And all the kids are like, yeah, but it looks awesome.
And you just go like, really cool.
Just go like, how are you going to win this? The kids will go like, wow, you've already captured my attention. I have no idea what's going on behind there. And what if there's some mischaracterizations of this guy? What if?
You think people would mischaracterize someone just to
of course not.
Just to keep people from looking at his book?
Yeah, of course not.
That's amazing that you would say that.
I do understand the fear that it's like, oh my gosh, he's going to indoctrinate and he's trying to lead people on this quest that ultimately the children will kill God. Part of me would just say, why not have more faith in your kids? Because I don't think anybody can wholesale lead a generation to such a bizarre conclusion that when in the heart of most little kids, they already start with a little closer affinity with a sense of spiritual things and God than most adults who have reasoned themselves out of that. It's like most kids are like, yeah, okay. They're not going like, oh yeah, let's kill God. They're not mad at it.
Right.
They're fine.
And is God killable even if you do want to wing him? Is that, you know, can
I'm
God
not,
jolly well take care of himself, I guess?
I think when you look at the crucifixion of Jesus, well, yeah, you did put him to death, but it didn't seem like you were able to get rid of him at all. It's like, I'm pretty sure he can get out of that predicament, too.
What's intriguing, though, is if people who are sending out all the scare email saying you can't see this movie... It's going to ruin people's view of the church. It's going to attack religion, all that stuff. You really see in the Christian culture we live in, there's not a separation between the religion and religious authorities and religious institutions and the life of Jesus.
No.
Somebody could bash on a lot of that. It has wronged and hurt a lot of people. And if you grew up in his environment, you've seen his version, whatever his version of that religion was, I know, but I'm not going to say it. If you've seen the abuses of it and you've seen people hurt and devastated by it, and this could really be a treatise on the failures of religion, which even the Pope admits there are some.
Right.
Maybe we could learn from it instead of reacting to it and putting our religion, and this is, I think, what happens. We even put our religion above who God is. And so if you attack my religion, you're attacking God. Could we not, in fact, point out the fallacies of religious obligation and the damage it has done people all over our world at the same time hold God way above that, to say God's not those abuses. He's not those mistakes. He's the God of glory, where we started this thing, who loves us and wants to invade our lives where we're most broken and bring us to wholeness.
And what religion out there isn't guilty of those things? I mean, it's not just, oh, poke on Christianity or don't poke on Christianity. It's like, gosh, any man-made structure that's trying to systematize this thing is going to have those failings.
That's why I think letters about, you know, church bashing, or in our sense, I don't think we bash the church, because I love the church. I want the church to rise in its full radiance and glory. We do bash on religion a bit, but religion...
Yeah, but I like that.
Well,
personally,
I'm okay with that, to be honest. But what you just said is, I think, really, really true as well. Religion does more bashing on... atheism here, a guy who put on a movie here. What religion is always bashing anybody who doesn't bow its knee to its power. And so it's not the goody-two-shoes things, and you go, oh, we're loving in the world. It's not loving in the world. It's a vulture looking for a carcass to land on.
Well, it's interesting. Nowhere in the Gospels do you get Jesus doing the let's have a bashing, you know, seminar. He was against some certain things. But
oh, he did his little scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites routine.
But
that was good.
That was the only crowd that he really went after. He's going like, gosh, just about everybody else, he's going like, hey, you know what? He's not against this, is with it. He's just like, what? And it's like, you look at that dynamic, and he wasn't looking at this from an insecure lens like, oh, we better stop them.
Yeah.
And I just don't get it when it's like, wait a minute, who is our God? He's the God of the universe. You don't get much. You don't get any higher. You don't get any better. You don't get any more glorious. What are we afraid of? Who? What little creature is going to do what to who? Who? Even Satan? Who, a created being? Even if he's spiritual and supernatural, it's like, yeah, but he's still a created being. And he's going to do what? And what's the problem here? When you really know who God is, we ought to be the most secure people on the planet.
Yeah, and couldn't we say, if you think you've got a religion that needs to be protected, then that's really all you have. And if you have the God of the universe, then you can live freely in the world. Recognize him. Somebody wrote me this week about, you know, some authors quoted from somebody and people on different theological bends and wondering how could you quote this person if they have a belief that, you know, I just said, you know what? Truth is truth. I don't care where it comes from. Truth is truth. And when
you don't really have to defend it, you don't have to protect it, you don't have to prove it.
Yes, G.K. Chesterton said, it's a lion. It'll jolly well defend itself.
Thank you for traveling with us on The God Journey. You can be part of the conversation by visiting our website, thegodjourney.com,